Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
This week's interview features a fascinating discussion with ex-Scientologist and author John Atack. John is the author of the book A Piece of Blue Sky, which has recently been updated and released under a new title, which we're going to talk about in this episode. And as we're going to hear, that's an interesting story in and of itself. But John is probably the world's foremost expert on the history of both Scientology as well as L. Ron Hubbard, who was, of course, the founder of the Church of Scientology. Even though he's now dead, what he started obviously lives on. And John is a fascinating guy because he's probably one of the most brilliant persons I've ever interviewed. He grew up in England. He was only 19 when he got into Scientology, and we're going to hear a little bit more about his backstory. Eventually, though, he left the Church of Scientology and then became an expert on L. Ron Hubbard and Scientology. He published the first factual history of Scientology in 1990. He's also the author of a book that came out in 2015 called Opening Minds, The Secret World of Manipulation, Undue Influence, and Brainwashing. And the thing I really appreciate about John the most, I guess, is not only is the fact that he's an expert on Scientology and L. Ron Hubbard, but he focuses more on the issue of recovering from the after effects of cult involvement. And that is something that I'm passionate about as well, something that I've been delving into since January of this year, because what I've found is, as Chris Shelton said, you strip away the ideology and you find the psychology, the tactics right across religion are very much the same. And that's why I love reading articles about things that John has written, because he talks about how to recover from your cultic experience. And that is something that we're going to get into toward the end of this episode. John's got some really practical advice for those who have walked away from controlling religion's high influence or religions with undue influence. So let's go on into it. We're going to find out what happens talking with John Atack when you question the dogma. I'm here with John Atack. I'm so glad to be finally meeting up with you, John. I think you're probably best known for your book, which was a bestseller, A Piece of Blue Sky, as well as you're the founder of Open Minds. Is it Open Minds Foundation or Open Minds Organization?
It's Foundation, yep.
Open Minds Foundation. And we're going to have to clarify this. You've recently reissued that book under a different title. Why did you change the title? And what is it now if people want to look up your book?
Let's sell these people A Piece of Blue Sky. When it originally came out, there was a precedent in U.S. law that you couldn't publish copyrighted unpublished material, and I was sued over that in New York, and the manuscript that had been stolen from me actually still had 60 passages taken from the journals, harassment orders, letters of Ron Hubbard. And by the time we got to court, of course, we knew this law, so we'd already changed it. So the stolen manuscript, I'd like to underline that word in red, stolen manuscript that they'd got and put into court, didn't do them any good. But it meant we had to publish it with paraphrases of 60 passages. So it was then lost in bankruptcy by the publisher. I've got 10 precedents in law in the US and here. I think that should put me in the Guinness Book of World Records. And one of them was that a publisher called Kensington was allowed to buy my book out of bankruptcy without my back royalties being paid, which is actually a violation of US law, made by the judge, though, not by Kensington. They're still publishing the original book, which, of course, has all of these passages paraphrased. So we put it back out so that I actually do get the royalties, which is a good thing. And it's not only got those 60 passages in it, but it's got about 40 more that I thought I'd throw in so you get your money's worth. And there's some pretty good things, like Aaron Hubbard, who was meant to have studied with gurus in the East, we actually got hold of his teenage journals, which are handwritten.
I seem to recall something about that when I was studying some things on L. Ron Hubbard. He was meant to have studied with these enlightened religious gurus while he was in China as a young man. But of course, Scientology doesn't want the truth to come out. Isn't that the real story?
Scientology put them into a court case in America thinking they'd always remain under seal. And the seal was lifted for 2 days. And the lawyer involved gave me copies of everything. So
you got access.
And in his, you know, of his study of with gurus as a young man in China, he said the only trouble with China is there are too many chinks there.
Oh,
and he's also his other profound thought was he went to a lamasery and said the monks sounded like bullfrogs, which is in fact the only comment about religion in the whole of his journals at that time. But you know, that in his imagination at least became studying with gurus as a young man.
Yes, I do want to get into the history of L. Ron Hubbard. I was going to say there's a couple things I wanted to get out of the way. First of all, I've got to say a thank you from a mutual friend of ours, Chris Shelton.
Yeah.
He kind of put me on to you, I think, originally, because several months ago I did a podcast with Chris on my show, and then I've been on his Sensibly Speaking podcast a few times, and I know you've been on it several times as well. So I want to say thanks to Chris Shelton for making this connection. The other thing is that I understand you and I are both drummers. Is that true? Do you still play drums?
I do, very much so. I mainly play a Roland. I've got a TDW-20. And I always said I'd never play an electronic kit. I had a lovely Rogers kit, 70s.
Your acoustic Rogers set.
Yeah, and then I played a TD-20 and went, okay.
I'm sold.
Yeah, it's fantastic. The only problem is it's too heavy to take anywhere.
That is a problem, especially as a drummer. The most work you have to do, tearing down, setting up, tearing down, setting up. We just did a gig last weekend, and it's a lot of work, man, for a drummer. Yeah. Guitar players, they just grab their amp and a guitar and a couple of cables, and they're away,
wimps.
Aren't they?
But they're wimps. What can you say?
Yeah, that's right. Luckily for us, our band, everyone kind of pitches in, so they're helping me out. But anyway, so I thought that was an interesting thing that we have that in common. So thanks to Chris Shelton and the fact that maybe we can sit down and play sometime. We've been talking about coming over to Nottingham area. So
I also have a 15-year-old who can get every sound out of a guitar that Jimi Hendrix got. And I hate
him. That's amazing.
I just hate him. You know, how can you do
it? How does he do it? Yeah, but he's only copying Hendrix. I mean, Hendrix was the master.
Well, you see, the thing is, I've heard loads of people like Robin Trower and Lenny Kravitz, lots of people copied Hendrix and found out how to make the sound. My son can tell you what Hendrix would have played, or can play you what Hendrix would have played at the next gig.
That's amazing.
He's got it in his head.
He's got an ear for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, Hendrix is a huge hero of mine. Every time I go to Seattle, I visited his grave a few times. And so, yeah, it's even though I'm a drummer, I appreciate the fact that he was a Seattleite like me. That's where I was born and raised. I came out of Christian fundamentalism, though, which is obviously quite different than your experiences in Scientology. I was reading a bit of your new edition of A Piece of Blue Sky and just kind of getting into the story of how you got into Scientology. I understand you were quite young when you got recruited into the cult. Or actually, did you get recruited in?
I didn't get recruited.
I
went to a friend's house, and there was a copy of a book called Science of Survival by Hubbard lying around.
Mm.
Many years later, as I researched the subject, had the privilege of meeting the guy who actually wrote it, which was Hubbard. It was Richard DeMille, who was the adopted son of the film director Cecil B. DeMille. And his
book. The Ten Commandments fame.
Yep. Exactly. One of the most famous film directors in the early period. And Richard DeMille worked with Hubbard for 3 months. And he, after writing Dianetics, the Modern Science of Mental Health, Hubbard published, I think, 27 other books. They didn't actually write any of them. They're all, somebody would take his notes and make a book out of them. Because I think when you have temporal lobe epilepsy, and I'm pretty sure Hubbard did, you don't have the patience to reread anything you've done. So whenever people went to him and said, look, you've completely contradicted yourself here. You go, I don't care. You know?
So what?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Give me the money. You know, give me the money.
And it seems like in reading your description of how you got sucked into the cult, you're a vulnerable young person, what, 18 or 19 years old, somewhere in there?
I'd been actually out in Toulouse for 6 weeks with a band.
Mm.
And everything had gone wrong. And I'd ended up, you know, coming home without my drums and finding that my girlfriend had disappeared. And it took me 4 days to find her, and she'd shacked up with one of our best friends, and off she'd gone. And I got very upset about it.
Yeah, I can imagine. So you're a classic person to be recruited or join a cult, really, aren't you? The classic vulnerable person profile.
Yeah.
You're struggling, you're having some issues. And here's this book that seems to, and the thing is reading your description, it seems like such a great, in theory, it would seem like such a great idea. It's a scientific approach to mental health.
That's it.
You're looking for help with your depression and your other anxiety issues and all these other things. Here's this book. And it seems so good. And is that how it kind of worked for you? It got you.
I went and found them. And I remember, you know, I checked them out. I rang up one of the local vicars, the Anglican vicar, and said, are these people okay? And he said, I've never heard of them, which is a bit weird because only 3 years before they'd been all over the newspapers because there'd been a government report quoting a great deal of Hubbard's material about harassing people and ruining them. And this vicar, rather than going, I'll check that out for you, just said, oh, I don't know anything about them. And I'd talked to a psychiatrist who said, I don't know, maybe they've got something, you know. They're so ignorant. And I think, sadly, the system is still pretty much the same now, that doctors and people who in religion don't necessarily know about destructive cults. What their supporters call new religious movements.
New religion, or as a church, of course. So they were granted tax exempt status in the United States years ago, and that now over and all this, you know.
It's a weird idea that it's the Internal Revenue Service who determine whether you're a religion or not in the United States.
Yeah, that's a strange one.
The theologians of the IRS.
Those great doctors of theology.
Yeah.
Well, it was a prolonged battle that Scientology waged with the IRS. That's really what kind of broke the back of the whole thing.
Well, they dropped 3,000 lawsuits on the day that they were granted exemption. So that's how many they brought just against people in the IRS.
Mm.
They are the most litigious group in the history of the known universe. And some of that litigation was with me, sadly, which was...
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, you were quite harassed, and it's classic Scientology tactics, isn't it? You're a suppressive person. You're a target of fair game, which is an actual policy set up by LRH.
Yep.
Anyone who is a dissenting voice, and I know you're experiencing all that, or you have experienced that. In fact, I know I came across, there's a hate website about you. I'm sure there's multiple ones.
One or two.
That's another classic tactic, isn't it, of Scientology?
This is the rarest book in Scientology.
The Basic Staff Hat Book, number one, and by L. Ron Hubbard.
The reason it's so rare is it actually contains the original of the Fair Game Law.
That's the actual black and white, yeah.
Well, green on white, actually.
Oh.
There it is, and wow. They put something over it. But
I can see it's starting to come out, yeah, in the camera.
Yeah.
Penalties for lower conditions, yeah, Hubbard's communication.
The one at the very bottom that's the relevant one. I'm not allowed to read it out because they sued me for violation of copyright. You can read it out.
So I'll be sued. It says, SP order, fair game, may be deprived of property or injured by any means, by any Scientologist, without any discipline of the Scientology, something may be tricked, sued, or lied to, or destroyed, says L. Ron Hubbard in 1967.
There you go. And there's how it's pasted out.
The fair game policy.
Yeah. Just for anybody out there who doesn't think we're telling the truth.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And of course, there's been so much exposure of this, of course, on the Leah Remini's Aftermath series, and they've talked about how Scientology has just absolutely harassed, tried to destroy people's lives. And in, I guess you could say in a way they have.
There are people who are dead. According to L. Ron Hubbard, there are people who are dead because they oppose Scientology.
They went after
him. That statement.
That's a chilling statement for sure. Fair game is bad enough, isn't it?
And the idea is basically to put so much pressure on you that you will leave them alone. And, of course, many people sign silence contracts with them. There was a period where my good friend Jerry Armstrong signed a silence contract because his lawyer, Michael Flynn, had said, there's no possibility of them upholding that. It breaks the Constitution.
Mm.
And 48 or however many contempt orders later, Jerry had to flee back to Canada rather than spend the rest of his life in prison. But he was one of, I think there were 25 cases, something like that, settled by Flynn, where Scientology handed over $5 million and made these secret silence contracts, which, of course, Bill Franks, who was one of the signatories, made public, where you're not supposed to talk about them. I mean, I had a lawyer who tried to negotiate with them to buy me off, and I had to stop her and say, I don't care how much money is involved. I'm not going to, take away my right of free speech.
Yeah, sign a contract and say nothing. Well, it's interesting going back to your own story when you were in Scientology. It seems like, I don't know how you would phase it now looking back on it as an ex-Scientologist, but it seems like when you start researching the actual history of L. Ron Hubbard, is that when the kind of the deconstruction starts to happen and you realize, wait a minute, I've got to get out of this thing? Or did that come after you had left the church?
Well, the church. What a lovely
church. It's in air quotes.
Let's talk about that a little while. The word church, up until the use of it by Ron Hubbard, meant a Christian organization. And the reason he used it, and I'm afraid Janet Reitman and various other people get it wrong. They pick up Scientology's own story, which is that the Church of Scientology came into being in February 1954, founded by a guy called Burton Farber in California. And it's not true. I would have given her the registration documents if she hadn't wanted to argue with me about trying to convince me that Scientology was a religion. But the registration documents from Camden, New Jersey in December 1953 show the first Church of Scientology registered by Ron Hubbard. But it's registered alongside the Church of Human Engineering, which thankfully didn't get going. Don't know what he'd have done with us. And the Church of American Science. And the Church of American Science, somebody was compiling a dictionary in Scientology. There were two 500-page dictionaries of Hubbard's neologisms and redefinitions.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody put in the Church of American Science, which basically says it's an organization for Christians so that they can be moved on to something better like Scientology. So the word church was initially used to attract Christians. And it's never been any kind of church. You know, if you go into the history of what that word means, it's like calling it the synagogue of Scientology. You know, it kind of rankles. You kind of go, that's not quite right. But it stuck, and they've stayed with it. My experience with it was all fine. I believed it from the age of 19 to the age of 28. I didn't have a hard time. So far, I think I'm unique in that. I don't think of the more than 1,000 Scientologists I've spoken to, all of them had something nasty happen. Some of them had some really nasty things happen to them.
Oh, yeah. You didn't get put in the hole or anything like that?
Well, I never worked for them. And because I was a writer, artist, musician type, even though I wasn't making any money at it, I was treated as a celebrity. And so they were very nice to me. And the only pressure was, I did have a 13-hour non-stop interview to try and get me to borrow £7,000 from a moneylender at 30% interest. But that was the hardest thing that happened to me. And I sat there at the end of it and went, no, thank you. And that was the end of that. But I was a bit hungry by then, I must say. But, you know, I've met people who, the hole is pretty bad. But Rats Alley in Los Angeles, I have a friend who was put into the ovens, the crematoria, which still exist in the blue buildings because it used to be the Cedars of Lebanon Hospital, cleaning out human remains.
Right.
Nasty things have happened to people. Horrible things have happened to people. I was really lucky. No humiliation, no abuse. When their senior lawyer, Kendrick Moxon, in a deposition said to me, did I consider I'd been brainwashed by Scientology? I said no. Hypnotized possibly from time to time.
Yeah.
Lied to significantly. Because I still, oddly enough, don't have any of those supernatural powers that they promise. And if they had, they wouldn't have to harass people, would they? You know, it's like...
It's all true.
They just stop you using their powers of mind.
Yes.
So,
what led you then to get into researching? Because you've been described as sort of the foremost expert on the history of the Church of Scientology and specifically L. Ron Hubbard, because it seems like on the face of it, L. Ron Hubbard is presented as this. He was an amazing person. He was an adventurer. He was a naval officer. He did amazing things. He traveled the world, as you say, as a young man.
A nuclear physicist.
He was an adventurer. He lived on a ship, and he did all kinds of things, and he healed himself through this science of what became Scientology. So the story goes. Mm-hmm. And it's something that, like you say, it doesn't rely on faith. It's purely scientific. It's better than psychology, better than psychiatry, on and on. And yet the real person of L. Ron Hubbard is quite different than the image that we're given in the Scientology documents.
Yeah, it's a complete confabulation. He claimed to be a nuclear physicist who had studied with gurus in India, China, Mongolia, and Tibet, in various different places. He made all those claims. Gurus in Mongolia. One wonders about that.
Gurus in Mongolia. Okay.
I've not heard of that, but maybe somewhere in the yurts eating yogurt in Mongolia. Probably somebody who'd learned everything he knew from a descendant of Genghis Khan. And let's face it, we're most of us descended from Genghis Khan. But so he studied with gurus in the East. He's a nuclear physicist, and he's applying hard Western science to Eastern mysticism. And by doing this, he cured himself of war wounds. Well, it comes down to it, as I say, the studies in the East didn't happen. He didn't go to India until he had actually founded Scientology. And the only time he spent there was in Calcutta Airport, as far as I can tell. He certainly didn't go to Mongolia or Tibet, you know.
So maybe he met a guru at the airport.
Yeah, that's probably it. Who told him the secrets of the East.
As he's waiting for his, queuing up for his flight.
He's just for 10 minutes. Get on with it.
And
the nuclear physicist, he actually admits that there's this beautiful lecture called An Introduction to Dianetics. I think it's the 23rd of September, 1950. And they've released it. And in it, he admits that he failed a course in atomic and molecular physics at university before he was thrown out. You know, just split a couple of hairs here. Atomic and molecular and nuclear physics are quite different subjects. You know, the science of the nucleus was not actually being taught when L. Ron Hubbard was at university in the early 1930s.
Right.
You know, the Copenhagen interpretation had only happened in 1928, so it sure as hell wasn't being taught in any universities. But it was bullshit. As for his war wounds, there's an interview with him in December 1950 in Look magazine, where he says that he had ulcers, conjunctivitis, pink eye. He'd had a fall on a ship down a ladder and had hurt his hip, and he'd got something wrong with his feet. And that, over the years, became, he'd got injured optic nerves, and it
in
was physical injuries to hip and back. I love the word, he's used the word physical in that sentence.
These physical injuries.
Psychosomatic injuries, they were physical. But it's bullshit. There's another story where Professional Auditor's Bulletin called Communication and Isness, where, having said that, you know, he spent the last year of the war in hospital because of his injuries and his injured optic nerves, he says that on the 25th of July, 1945, he was down in Hollywood and he's attacked by three petty officers and he beats them up, which for a blind cripple was some going.
It's pretty good.
I've been told by one of his contemporary defenders that it was a surge of adrenaline that allowed him to do this. And I'm kind of going, how does adrenaline cure injured optic nerves? But which then, of course, lapsed into blindness again. Interviewing the woman he was living with at the time he was claiming his pension in the 40s, she had a slightly different story and said that when he was doing his hypnotic affirmations about how ill he was, he would be very ill. And then he'd snap out of it when he came back from the interview where he tried to get his pension. And he claimed a war pension for injuries till his dying day. I think it was $38 a month that he got.
Yeah, so it wasn't big money. Well, it seems like he was trying to claim that, yeah, he wanted to say he'd been injured in combat so the Navy would pay him out, which, of course, he never, I don't think isn't true. He never actually saw actual combat in World War II.
He did have command once, and he waged a 55-hour battle at sea off the coast of Oregon against a magnetic deposit.
Yeah, I heard about that. He bombed a magnetic deposit for hours and hours or something.
55 hours, and he called in, you know, dirigibles, balloons, and they dropped depth charges as well.
Wow.
And after that, it was said he was not fit for command, and he was never given command again. But he made up all sorts of stories. My friend Chris Owen has written a wonderful book called Ron the War Hero, for anybody who wants to get into the detail of that. But yeah, I mean, I worked on a biography of him with Russell Miller, Sunday Times journalist and biographer, who wrote a wonderful book called Barefaced Messiah. And, you know, we got all sorts of trivial details. We found out all sorts of things. When it comes to the submarine battle off the Oregon coast, of course, after World War II, the Allies actually were very concerned that the high command of Japan or Germany might escape. And so they traced every submarine sinking, and none of them were sunk off the Oregon coast, sadly. So
unfortunately. So L. Ron Hubbard's story didn't stack up. Well, it seems like in looking at his life, from what I've researched, there were things that he actually did do. You know, he was in the Navy. Like you say, okay, he really was. When he was, isn't it true, when he was a child, I think he grew up in Montana, didn't he?
He traveled to
China. His father was I think it was a business trip, wasn't it?
And his father was in the Navy.
His father was in the military.
He got free passage out, and he went out twice. And the second time, he'd actually run away from home and got passage out there. So, Russell Miller said, you know, the guy actually did enough to talk about. He didn't need to magnify.
Exactly. And that's the impression that I got from reading and researching him, is there are things that he genuinely did do that were interesting, but yet then he embellished them so far. As, like you're saying, the story of the submarine attack off the Oregon coast and these meeting with gurus in Mongolia and all this. And he came back to his hometown in Montana, and he's being interviewed by the newspapers. And at this time, this is what, in the 1930s, to travel outside to China, I mean, nobody was doing that back in the 1930s. So he had a free rein to kind of make up whatever. There's a long history of him embellishing stories, as you say, going back to when he was even a teenager. Isn't that right?
Well, the three copies of his diaries that I have, one of them is a retype of one of the two handwritten diaries. And you can see he's already improving the stories. But that's fine. You know, that's the case with a lot of writers of fiction, Thomas Mann said that a novelist has no friends because you steal their lives and put them in your books, you know. But so, you know, for a writer to be doing that, that's fine. The problem was that he was selling it, and he was saying, I cured myself of war wounds, so this will cure you. And he started to sell his cure all that would give you, you know, fantastically high IQ, perfect health. You would never catch a disease again of any kind. Bacteria and virus would run away when it saw you coming. You would have perfect memory, all of these things. And it was none of it true. Indeed, what he'd done was simply grabbed Breuer's method that had been used by Freud on Anna von O. Two other charlatans, by the way, Breuer and Freud there. Just like to throw that in. Go and read Frederick Kruse's book about the fraud of Freud.
The fraud of Freud.
They cross out the E in his name on the cover. So a brilliantly researched book and thoroughly shows a very similar narcissistic personality to Hubbard. Somebody who was convinced that the world was trying to destroy him and, you know, that he'd had brilliant ideas. And you find out that, in fact, the first person that this technique was used on, Anna von O, she became herself a psychoanalyst and absolutely criticized Freud and Breuer. The end of her therapy that Freud had written about so glowingly was that she was admitted to an asylum as a morphine addict because Josef Breuer had given her morphine as part of the therapy. So she ended up an addict. That was how well that went. And I'm afraid that Scientology has many similar stories, that people didn't actually achieve perfection of health and spirit and mind. They ended up suicidal and in some cases dead. There's a pretty high suicide rate in Scientology, perhaps because of the disappointment, perhaps because of the cruelty, that if it doesn't work, it's your fault. And if anything good happens, it's because you gave them $500,000 or whatever it costs at the moment to do Scientology. It is a terrible thing. You asked me about how I left. I continued to believe, and then we started to feel that Hubbard was gone. And so we started to protest and tried to take Scientology out of the mother cult, let's say. And so I was, in fact, one of the founders of the independent Scientology movement in the United Kingdom, and I found myself at the very center of it. And then I got this huge package of documents from a guy called Michael Lynn Shannon, stack of documents, which had got Hubbard's school reports and university grades. And this guy had done an amazing job and then disappeared completely. I spent years trying to find him to thank him. And he'd just, like, I'm not getting involved. He'd been harassed, or maybe he'd been dumped down a hole somewhere. But reading this material, which I just went straight through it. I didn't sleep. I just went straight through it. And a lot of people say, oh, there's forged documents, all of these, you know, people out to get him. And it was, no, this is, it's consistent. So I then went off and sort of went, well, okay, if Hubbard was, you know, a lying bastard, which he was, then it still doesn't invalidate the usefulness of the counseling technology.
Right. It could still be true.
So I hung on for a couple of months after that. And then I kind of went, you know, these promises that are being made, they're nonsense. We, you know, for example, one of the lower levels of Scientology is the communication release. And it means you have the ability to talk freely on any subject to anyone. But there are certain provisos about that. You can't talk to people who've been declared suppressive by Scientology. You can't talk about Scientology because that's called verbal technology and it's not permitted. You can't talk about your own problems because that's talking about your case. But apart from that, you can talk freely to anyone on any subject. It's a nonsense. And I sort of ended up defending the independence for the next decade. And, you know, anybody who came to me for 12 years after I left, I would do what I could to help them sort things out. While researching the history of the group and writing a book that's mainly based upon Hubbard's own statements, that by, as I say, you find this 1950 introduction to Dianetics where he actually tells the truth about his life. It's a rare moment, but of course, as he admitted elsewhere, he was a phenobarbital addict, a barbiturate addict. It's called Nembutal in the UK. And he tried to catch a prescription signed Dr. L. Ron Hubbard here in 1965. And they wouldn't give it to him because they said a PhD doesn't actually allow you to do that. And it was a fake PhD anyway.
He didn't have a real PhD anyway.
No, it was from Sequoia University, which was part of a group called the Scientology Council that had awarded him the PhD. But
how convenient.
The interesting thing about phenobarbital is that not only were people writing about using the technique that he called Dianetics about 5 years before he published it, that they were using phenobarbital on the people. It was being used on US airmen who were traumatized in North Africa, flying missions like Yusarian and his friends in Catch-22. And the two psychiatrists, Grinker and Spiegel, who wrote this work, they were abreacting. They were getting people to relive their trauma, which is what Dianetics is meant to be. But they were giving them phenobarbital. And the curiosity is that Hubbard, in his medical records, which are, of course, you know, after he died, I wrote off and got them. It says he was taking phenobarbital. And in the lecture, he says he made himself a guinea pig on an experiment in addiction and said how hard it was to come off phenobarbital. So we have absolute confirmation that he took it. It is a relative of the truth drug. And I think that maybe on this day in September 1950, he'd taken a bit too much of it. You know?
He actually told the truth.
Yeah. And the problem for anybody who's involved is not what anybody else says about him or what the records say. It's that he contradicts himself massively. And so you know he's a liar. And he himself said, honesty is sanity. So you know, take what, you know, what lesson you will from that. He also said that the guy who makes the rules of the game doesn't have to follow the rules.
Yeah, he was exempt somehow.
Yeah, well, he didn't follow it. He didn't do it himself.
Yeah. Do you think that Hubbard actually thought that he was advancing something for the betterment of humanity? And because the story seems to be that he writes this book and approaches real psychiatrists and psychologists, and they basically laugh him out of the place in a sense. Is that, and then this is still what fuels a lot of the Scientologists' anger towards psychotherapy, psychology, psychiatry. Is that kind of the narrative of how it works?
Some psychologists took him seriously. Two of his first five foundations, in fact, were led by psychologists. Carl Rogers, the founder of humanistic psychology, said that he might have had some good ideas. Fritz Perls, the founder of Gestalt therapy said that Hubbard had had some good ideas. But I must say that I'm not tremendously impressed with their ideas either.
Right. They might be a bit suspect too.
Yeah. And, you know, it's an interesting field when you look at psychology and the amount of, you know, you look at behaviorism, John Watson and B.F. Skinner, that they invented this idea that you couldn't know what was happening in the human mind, which was great good fun, which lasted well into the 70s. When people who were beginning to work with artificial intelligence started showing that you could find out what was happening in the human mind. And you don't necessarily want to know what's happening in there.
Yeah.
But this cult dominated university courses in psychology in the US, really from Watson in the 1920s into the early 70s. And since then, we've had repressed memory therapy, and half of the members of the American Psychological Association believed in this nonsense. And my experience in talking now with many people who've had trouble in their lives is that if something horrific happened to you as a child, you might well not remember the details of it. That is true. But you will remember that something horrific happened. And the repressed memory therapists are finding, you know, generally women in their 30s whose lives are grey and lukewarm, and then spending anywhere up to 5 years persuading them that they were satanically abused or something like this. That came and went. We now have eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which tens of thousands of psychologists have adopted as a method to alleviate trauma. And it's basically a version of neurolinguistic programming, the famous cult of the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, I was going to say, that rings a bell with me. I've heard about NLP.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in that field as well, I have all sorts of difficulties, and it would be true to say that Scientology does use many of the techniques that already existed or that would come into being in other groups. So it's rather difficult in a field like clinical psychology to really get hard data. The point really is that Scientology uses guided imagination. So you're made all sorts of promises, which if you sit back and think about them for a few minutes, aren't true.
You know, possibly be true.
Yeah. You know, they finally, in 1988, released their highest level. David Miscavige is still trying to find the 15 levels that apparently exist above, and spent over $10 million having a man called Pat Broker followed around the clock just in case he'd got them, because he was the guy that Hubbard actually appointed his successor. But the last level says that you will be, I have a book here somewhere. This is the last time that it was ever made public, in 1974.
The Book of Basics.
Yeah, the pages in here that relate to what you will achieve in Scientology were never reprinted again, because it was felt that they could be sued basically for making these claims. And it says operating Thetan, which is means a spirit that can leave the body and operate exterior outside of the body. The complete operating Thetan level 8 will give you the ability to be at cause knowingly and at will over thought, life, form, matter, energy, space, and time, subjective and object.
That's pretty comprehensive. It covers pretty much everything.
So again, why bother to harass people if you can do that to them?
But exactly.
You know, I used to, when I was giving lectures, I'd put a little bit of tinfoil out and say, okay, if there are any OTs out there, you know, watching this being streamed, or in the audience, I just want you to move this piece of tinfoil an inch or a centimetre if you're more metric, you know, and it never happened. And yet they claim they can move clouds and change traffic lights. You know.
They can't move a piece of tinfoil.
No.
For sure, the genius of the Scientology system is how Hubbard conceived of this sort of bridge, isn't it? That's the real genius of the scam. It's a scam. I think a lot of people will say that. It's a money making system whereby once you get sucked into the lower levels, you have to start paying more and more and more and more money, to where you people, like you say, spend millions eventually over the course of decades pursuing higher and higher levels, trying to achieve the status of clear and all this. That's the real genius of the system, isn't it? The money-making aspect of it.
And he had plenty of time to work on it. Originally, when he wrote his book Dianetics, it was like, you know, this is it. This will get you to a state of perfection. A year later, they don't talk about this a lot, but a year later, he actually cancelled the original techniques because they were hypnotic. You know, that's what he says.
He was a hypnotist himself, wasn't he?
Oh, he boasted that he learned hypnosis at the age of 16, that he was hypnotizing, putting a towel on his head in 1948 in Los Angeles and, you know, hypnotizing people. We found people who'd actually been hypnotized by him at that time doing stage hypnosis, you know, often at fan meetings, because he wrote science fiction and before that Western pulps and things like that. They were not big business. They didn't pay well, but you got some fans, you know, and so you'd have these meetings with 50 people there and you'd hypnotize one of them. One of his favorites was to get somebody to imagine they'd got a tiny kangaroo on their hand. Russell Miller interviewed a guy. He said his brother had been hypnotized by Hubbard to go to this street corner at 2 o'clock every Friday afternoon. And for weeks afterwards, he didn't know why he was going there. He'd be doing it. So he was quite good at that. He also said, never believe a hypnotist, you know, which is the title of a paper I wrote where I deconstruct a few dozen of his statements about hypnosis in his work, showing that by his definition, Dianetics and Scientology are most definitely forms of hypnosis. They're guided imagination.
You should believe him. Now, I know you've been doing a lot of work on undue influence. This is kind of I read some of your papers on your website about cognitive dissonance and things where you're talking about how this works. What about people who are under undue influence? Can you define what that term means? Because I know that people will look at Scientology, they'll say, okay, I think it's a cult. If they start researching it, they go, yeah, it's definitely a cult. Mm-hmm. What do you mean when you say undue influence, and how does that relate to cult studies and the world of the cults?
Well, you could actually simply replace the word undue with the word excessive.
Mm.
It's a legal term that goes back hundreds of years. I started using it in the 80s because I got tired of academic cult apologists saying there's no such thing as brainwashing. And you're going, well, brainwashing is, let's take that as a separate subject. I'm very happy to talk about what that is. But the allegation is not brainwashing. The allegation is exploitative persuasion, an excess of influence, getting people to do things that are against their own best interests. So, you know, going and borrowing huge amounts of money. I spoke with a guy a few years ago who I think he'd borrowed £35,000 to pay for towards a building that Scientology wanted to make. And he was told he'd have a car parking space.
That was what he was going to get out of the deal.
And by the time I met him, he'd been working two jobs for several years to try and pay back this money. Now, there's no real protection except in law, the undue influence law, which goes way back into certainly the early 17th century here. Lord Francis Bacon held a famous case with a Mrs. Death, and she basically conned this old, very old guy into living in her house. Her own husband had died along the way, we don't know how, and she'd come to inherit everything from this guy, and the case went before Francis Bacon, the most famous judge come philosopher of his day, often accused of having written the works of Shakespeare. But nonetheless, a brilliant man, wrote the Novum Organum. I don't know what that means, but it sounds very good. He ruled on this case and basically said the fact that she'd left him in soiled bedclothes, whipped him, and meant that she shouldn't get the money, that she had undue influence over him. Mm. If you give gifts to your priest, your counselor, your lawyer, anybody who has authority over you, there is a presumption that you have, that they have an undue influence over you. And technically, you should be able to ask for those things back. And it's the only aspect of law I know where the lawyer, priest, counselor is presumed guilty until proven innocent. They have to give you that lovely box of chocolates back, or that motor car, or that apartment.
Whatever it is.
Whatever it was. That's undue influence. I started using that term. I'm not totally happy with it. Law professor Alan Shefflin, who's emeritus now, brilliant guy, he spent decades trying to have it recognized that this form of coercive control, exploitative persuasion, does exist. And he had great difficulty. You know, the American legal system just won't accept this. And I know a couple of years ago, he was saying, well, maybe we should call it predatory influence.
Mm.
But since then, in law, it's been renamed coercive control. And since 2015, we have a law on the statute books here. But it only applies to one-on-one relationships as yet. And We'd like to show that you can join an authoritarian group, or you can get into an authoritarian relationship. And what interested me in the early 90s, having written, let's sell these people a piece of blue sky, and sort of gone, I really don't want to do this for the rest of my life, you know. I started getting more and more interested in the dynamics of why would people become involved? Why would somebody bankrupt themselves to try and achieve this thing? What's being offered? And so I read all of the available literature, and there wasn't that much of it. You know, William Sargent's Battle for the Mind, published in 1957, Snapping by Conway and Siegelman, originally published in 78, Menticide by Joost Meyerloo. To try and understand this, and I read about compliance psychology, about Milgram and Solomon Ash and Edgar Schein. I had the good fortune to get to know Margaret Singer and Jolly West. I'm usually told off for mentioning Jolly because of all the conspiracy theories all over the internet about him. But nonetheless, Jolly was an incredibly knowledgeable, highly educated man. And by talking with him, I have a 30-year friendship with Stephen Hassan. In this country, we have the wonderful Christian Cherko, who is almost unknown, who spent 40 years helping people recover from their involvement with destructive authoritarian groups. By talking with people, by reading what was available psychologically, I sort of came to some simple conclusions. And one of them was that talking about things as cult groups or not cult groups wasn't particularly helpful, because people just get emotional about that. Using words like brainwashing was not in the least bit helpful. Is there a spectrum of compliance? Can you get people to do things that are against their own interests? And I think the answer to that is yes. So what are those things? And I became, in the 90s, I started reading about terrorism. So, you know, before the 9/11 thing, I'm sort of going, well, I can sit down with a Scientologist and in a day get them to reconsider what they believe, not by arguing with them about Scientology, but by giving them a little bit of a psychological education, by showing them on video, not in practical demonstrations, how guided imagination works, and getting them to reconsider their involvement. And that always worked. Whenever anybody was willing to stay in the room with me, because some of them went, oh, you're a suppressive person.
Yeah, got to get out of here.
Yeah. But whenever anybody was willing to have a conversation with me, they would reconsider their involvement. And my intention was never to get anybody to leave Scientology. That would be up to them. But they all did. And so because it was fairly well bruited about that Scientology was the most difficult group to get people out of, because where transcendental meditation has two techniques, Scientology has 2,000. It's incredibly invasive. For decades afterwards, ex-members will refuse to change their minds. They will hold on to these concepts for dear life. And I found out how to slip my way through that. So I figured I could probably do what is now called de-radicalizing. I became very interested in Islam and how people were becoming radicalized through the tiny little faction of Wahhabis or Salafis, certainly not through mainstream Sunni or Shia Islam. I came, in fact, to have a great respect for some of the people I met and some of the things that were being taught about being nice to people among the Sufis or what have you. But I wanted to understand, and it was, well, actually, this is about people. It's not about any kind of group. So if somebody has an experience of, or had the great good fortune for the last 4 years, Chris Shelton's also interviewed Yuval Lahore, who has the word awe in his name, Lahore. I gave a 5-day seminar in Toronto, which is online. It's called Getting Clear. It's on Vimeo, which I still think is the only time anybody's thoroughly deconstructed an authoritarian group. But he wandered into the seminar and said, oh, I've been using your work for 20 years. And I was like,
okay.
I haven't heard from you before. And he'd gone and done a PhD in which he'd looked at states of awe and fervor. And we talk pretty much every week. We spend a lot of time going through his ideas, which I think he's absolutely brilliant. And he's come to a way of showing how, no matter how good our critical thinking might be, which is where most people say, oh, well, you just weren't logical, you know, that's your problem, that's why you got scammed. Well, that's not true. I knew a couple of NASA scientists in Scientology. I knew 8 medical doctors.
They can be brilliant people.
Yeah. and my own critical thing.
Everything else, yeah.
Yeah, I took people out of cults before I got into Scientology.
Mm-hmm.
But they got me, and it'll be an emotional thing. And one of the core notions is certainty. Why are we sure of things? You know, and the story I always tell, when I was 17, I spent 2 hours having a pleasant conversation with a born-again Christian who backed away from me terrified in case I sprouted horns or something. Because I just asked him some questions from my reading of the gospel. And he said, look, I don't understand the Bible, but I know it's all true. And that idea really struck with me. I don't understand it, but I know it's true. How is it possible? Now, we're all the same. You know, that we all have what's called the my side bias, the confirmation bias, that I know what I know. And if you disagree with me, you're wrong. You know, which obviously in my case is true. But for other people,
that's not true. When we find information that agrees with our bias, isn't that that's part of the problem of the internet now, isn't it?
Oh, the echo chamber. Yeah,
I can find anything that agrees with my point of view and disproves yours in the bargain.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's what resonates with me emotionally. The great founding psychologist William James talked about the noetic experience, where somebody has an experience that confirms for them that something is the truth. And the simple one with this is, if you get somebody who's never done meditation, say, and you sit them and you get them to look at a wall for 10 minutes, then they'll experience what's called the Ganzfeld effect. They look at a white wall and they'll start seeing colors rippling down it. And then they'll start to feel a sense, probably, of euphoria. Because if you sit still and rest the brain and give it no stimulation, it starts to fill in, it starts to put stuff out there. But you also get this altered state. Now, if they're not familiar with this, and they then get this, they get high, they get euphoric, you can then slip in this idea that you, as the person who gave them this miraculous technique, have a grand knowledge of the universe. And you get guru status. So you have awe that is inspired, that then creates a feedback loop of fervor. So that people will come to regard the leader as a kind of parental figure. I mean, people like Sun Myung Moon, he called himself True Father. So there you go. It wasn't very true, actually. He was a lying dog. But who has had sex with a great many women, you know, in very unpleasant. He was convicted of rape. Did you know that? Sun Myung Moon in 1955 was convicted of rape in Korea. But yet he was the second coming of Jesus, according
Yes, he was. Yeah. I've read Stephen Hassin's book about his experiences as a Moonie, basically, and how he got recruited into the cult. You know, so it can happen to anybody, as you said. Yeah. Anyone can get recruited in. And he kept telling himself, I'm a smart, intelligent person. This is not happening to me. This is not going to happen. And yet he did.
Yeah. And because, as Steve admits, there were some pretty girls, you know. And
yeah. That's how they get you in. Whatever it takes.
A pretty girl is like a malady, as the song says. But you have some kind of experience, and that experience has truthiness. And away you go. So the big question is, for anybody to keep asking ourselves, is why do I believe this? Why am I sure of this? You know, I get unpleasant because I'm an agnostic. I don't have to justify any beliefs because I don't have any. So I can be, you know, difficult with anybody.
Yeah.
When I meet a militant atheist, a dork, a follower of Dawkins,
right,
they want to tell me there, you know, how wrong these people who believe in sky fairies are and all of that stuff. And I say, well, what do you believe? And they say, well, I believe in the Big Bang. And you say, well, do you realize that Big Bang theory was originated by a Catholic priest called Georges Lemaître? And they go, no. I said, do you realize that there's a papal encyclical from the 1950s that says it's acceptable to believe it? No. Do you realize that Stephen Hawking said that it was a possible proof of the existence of God? No. And now, could you tell me what the Big Bang is? And they might manage to tell me it's where a p-membrane of 11 dimensions collapses into 4 dimensions, and they might not. But I've never met anybody yet who actually could show me the mathematical proofs of the Big Bang, which is to say that, well, I tend to believe in the Big Bang, but I think there have probably been a lot of them, and I'd like to know who had them. I tend to believe in it, but it's because it's consistent with other things I believe. It's not because I can prove it. So that's kind of like reading the Bible and saying, well, it's true because it says it's true in here.
It's circular logic, isn't it?
Yeah. But we are sure of it because our community believes it. By the way, Darwin, often claimed as an atheist, he was very determined about that. He said, I am an agnostic.
So there is a difference, yeah.
Yeah.
I've run across...
I'm not that clever. You know?
Yeah. I know what you mean. I've run across what we call evangelical atheists or militant atheists, and they're just as intent on correcting your false or wrong beliefs, you know, and that's the sort of thinking that comes into it. You're wrong and I've got to correct you, rather than just, hey, if that works for you, you know, whatever, I don't know. But I'm interested too, and I know we're kind of getting on time here, but your work on reconstruction after you leave a cult or a group of undue influence, what's your advice for people who are trying to reconstruct and rebuild that sort of lost identity that may have gotten subsumed into the group?
Well, step one is to look after yourself physically. One of the most important errors in our society is to do with sleep. Last year, there have been two studies of the UK bio cohort, one of 433,000 people, the other of over 600,000 people, which has shown conclusively that at least 9% of people have a delayed sleep-wake phase. And it's genetic. It runs through all the clocks in your body. It may actually be as many as 20% of us. And if you sleep out of time with that, and society will force you to, because obviously people who stay up at night are evil. It's well known. We all know that. If you try and fight with that, it will mess you up horribly. Mm. So sleep is my first thing, that find your own sleep cycle. If you've just left a group, find out when it's comfortable for you to sleep and get sleep, because the restorative value of sleep to your thinking and to your feelings is probably greater than anything else we do. And it's a huge mistake. It's said that a third of people in our culture don't get enough sleep. So firstly, sleep. Secondly, nutrition. Be careful not to shove too much sugar into your system, and you know, undereating is a commonplace. Overeating is a commonplace. Don't believe all this bullshit about how extra protein is going to do you any good. It isn't. But make sure you get protein from whatever source. So eat properly. Exercise. You know, all the simple, with the simple medical things that you're getting a little bit of exercise, but not stretching yourself too much. Then spend only half of your time obsessing over the cult. Spend the other half of your time doing something you like doing, dancing, swimming, cycling, playing the drums. Talk to other people about it, and don't just talk to people who've been involved with your cult or with other cults, so-called cults. Talk with ordinary people who've got no idea what you're talking about, and try and explain what you believed to them. I mean, find people who won't kind of...
run away, back away slowly.
Yeah, but also people who won't say, God, you're a twit, you know. Find people who are sympathetic and willing to listen to you droning on, and explain the basic principles of what you believed, because by voicing what you believed to an uninformed audience, an audience that doesn't understand it, you will find out a great deal about what you believed and get it away. My number one tip is about the credibility of the teaching. Many people are involved in trying to help recovery, will give you all of the everything else but the dogma. Now, for me, the dogma is the core. You can't just walk away. You've got to say, well, which of it do I still believe? What do I still believe? So I've dealt with many people who've left the Watchtower, Jehovah's Witnesses, and they will move, they'll become Christians of some other form. And I want them to talk about what they believe. And if it ends up being pro-social, something that has a high regard for other people and compassion for other people, no matter their gender, their sexual persuasion, their country of origin, their linguistic group, their ethnicity, whatever. If they're following some teaching that respects other human beings and gets them to act socially, then that's great. I don't really care what they believe. you know, because it's the compassion and humility, the pro-social aspect that's important. But very often people never question the dogma. And my story here is this wonderful woman who's a very good friend of mine now, but 5 or 6 years ago, a journalist came over from Australia, Steve Canane, and a lovely guy, wrote a great book called Fair Game, which is very funny in places about the history of Scientology in Australia, very accurate too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's a lovely guy, but he's a journalist. And okay, I've dealt with a couple of hundred journalists, not my favorite people, I'm afraid. Mm-hmm. But every now and then you'll find one of them with an actual heart. You know, it's like they've done their Wizard of Oz stuff and they got a heart. And Steve's one of those, really compassionate guy. And he said, look, there's this young woman I've interviewed on TV and she was born into it. She was two, I think, when they got into it. And she just had a bloody horrible time. Will you talk to her? And I said, look, I don't really do that anymore, Steve. You know, I occasionally talk to Australian journalists who are writing books, but that's my limit now. And he explained the case a bit further to me and I went, all right, I'll talk to her. This sounds awful. When I talked to her, she'd been out of Scientology for 16 years. She said to me, is it true that reality is an agreement? Fundamental notion of Scientology is that we're all of us agreeing that it's all out there.
Mm-hmm.
Same time, Hubbard said, we're all chanting space, particle, position, space, particle, position in one of his less comprehensible works. And there are many of them like that. And I sort of said, well, yeah, if you're a hypnotist, that is true. Reality is an agreement with the hypnotist and whatever they tell you will be real.
Mm-hmm.
Your imagination will fill in the rest, I'm afraid. But for the rest of us, no. The next week when we talked, she said that she'd just done some washing using scented laundry conditioner. Now, we both knew what had happened. We hadn't talked about the Sea Organization hygiene hat, which tells you that you cannot use anything scented because just like Rajneesh, Ron Hubbard had a scent fetish, an anti-scent fetish. He was phobia, rather. He was absolutely, you know, Rajneesh had sniffers who, as you walked into the room, would make sure you hadn't got any perfumes on and you didn't smell bad. Hubbard had his clothes rinsed, I think, eventually 17 times in water to make sure. And rose perfume was being used to control the universe by psychiatrists and all sorts of demented ideas. So I knew when she said she'd used a scented laundry conditioner that she'd broken a taboo, but I also knew that we hadn't talked about it. The important thing is to be able to question the dogma and say, well, what do I believe now? Talk about that with people, and it releases the bonds, the things that are holding you in there. She went on from there on, any idea that came up that was related to Scientology, she could think about it and say, well, I still agree with that, or I don't agree with that. The other thing is, you know, don't forget the benefits you got, if you did. If there was any, you know, Mark Headley wrote a wonderful book about Scientology, which actually has some of the funniest stories I've ever read in it. But Mark became a sound recordist in Scientology and learned to a very high level. So he's been able to get good jobs ever since. So that's something that he got. But it can also be that you do feel that there was some therapeutic benefit. You know, as a suppressive person, I'm not meant to say this about Scientology. But if somebody comes to me and says, look, you know, I mean, I was suicidal and then I had some auditing and I felt better, I say, great. But the truth is that you're attributing the benefit to the auditing, whereas the benefit should be attributed to you. If I'm counseling somebody and they achieve something, that's their achievement.
Yeah, they've had a breakthrough.
I facilitated it maybe, but you know, it's down to the person having the experience to own it.
Because it is a form of therapy at the end of the day. I think a lot of, this is something that Chris mentioned, that a lot of people who get sucked into Scientology initially, because they're talking about their own problems in the first few sessions and things, it's like a therapy session. And you do feel better because you're unloading your problems and your issues on a stranger. A therapist in a sense. And so you've unburdened yourself. You feel a cathartic sort of experience has happened. And so that you can see the appeal of an organization like Scientology, especially for someone who says, well, it doesn't have any faith element attached to it. It's a scientific research-based method that's proven to work, and on and on and on. And of course, they don't know what they're getting involved in.
You also have a fundamental contradiction. Hubbard said you never evaluate for the pre-clear, the person who's receiving auditing. You never evaluate for them. You never explain anything for them. However, they will have read 25 of Ron Hubbard's books,
right,
explaining what's meant to happen to them. You also have the comfort of ritual. You know, we see it in church going that the ritual is the same every time. You know, if you're a Catholic, you genuflect when you go into church. There is something very satisfying about that. And auditing also has this ritualistic aspect to it that you get used to this idea. Also, as you're paying for it, you've got somebody who's going to listen to whatever nonsense you wish to spout.
Right.
You know, at £200 an hour. I, by the way, if anybody watching this would like to give me £200 an hour and spout nonsense, they can forget it, because I don't care. It'd have to be at least £500 an hour.
At least 500.
The other thing about leaving is that you should definitely read this book.
Yep.
Take Back Your Life.
I read it.
Yeah.
Take Back Your Life by Janja Lalić and Tobias.
Madeline Tobias. And yeah. I mean, there's more recently, Janja has published Escaping Utopia for second generation members. And it is very definitely different when somebody's born into a group.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's my story. I was born into a fundamentalist Christian. I consider it a cult in the Seattle, Washington area.
And what was the name of the group?
The name of the group, it was headed by a guy called Bill Gothard. Institute of Basic Youth Conflicts was what it was called then. Now it's called Institute in Basic Life Principles.
Neither of them very snappy titles. That's
fun. Oh, yeah. They love their titles. IBLP, it's you know, rolls off the tongue.
Sounds like a disease.
Yeah. Doctor, I've got a bad case of IBLP, I think. But, you know, it's one of those, it's a cult where it's a fundamentalist Christian cult. They're very much into the purity culture. But the thing about IBLP is they've got all their tentacles in homeschooling and businesses and prisons, and they're in Romania and Russia, and they've got orphanages. I mean, they've got all sorts of front organizations, and they are unbelievable the more you go into it. And so a lot of people have been damaged by that, being raised in this cult, really, as I see it. So yeah, I've done a lot of research on that. There's a difference between first and second generation cultists, really, isn't there? In the sense of their identity and recovering that identity.
Yeah, if you don't have, you know, if you have a pre-cult set of identities, I don't think any of us has a single identity.
Yeah,
you know, we have an identity regarding who we're talking to. So if I'm, you know, if I was talking to one of my parents or one of my children or my dog or my employer or my employee, those are different identities. If I'm in a different mood, then that will give a variation of identity. What tends to happen in I call them authoritarian groups now, because the word cult has become, and if it's not authoritarian, it's not a problem. You know, if it is authoritarian, it is a problem. I had Eileen Barker in the audience at Manchester a couple of months ago, which was amazing. You know, having one of the great cult apologists actually sat in my audience, and I pointed out that I don't mind her calling things new religious movements, but I wish she'd accept that there are authoritarian new religious movements.
That's a critical distinction.
And so if your identity was formed, or your personality, the strands of identity within your personality was formed within the group, then you have a quite different challenge, because you will feel that you have to develop an identity. Whereas somebody who's leaving a group, I mean, I saw it in Scientology that so much, you know, almost all of my friends and many people I knew, they'd leave Scientology, they'd grow their hair long and start smoking dope, you know, or something like that.
Yeah, get a tattoo.
That was where they were before, and they could, you know, they could. And I got this feeling that whenever you leave such a group, you are 11 or 12 years old, you know, in terms of whatever you were before you got in, because you've got that last stage of dependency before puberty. And so people go into puberty when they leave the group and start being naughty and doing bad things that the group wouldn't allow them to do. And that's actually, you know, as long as it's not,
Very self-destructive.
You know, It's and I think in Seattle now dope is legal, isn't it?
It is. Yes, in Washington State.
I wouldn't smoke it personally because I think smoking thing's bad for you. But it's, I think especially if your childhood was stolen from you, that it's quite important to hang out with kids and do the, you know,
recover that adolescent, as it were.
Well, and have, you know, I don't know about watching Disney movies because that's not cultic of itself, you know, but certainly Toy Story is pretty good. The last one was very grim, I thought, you know.
I haven't seen the final one yet, but.
Really?
Quite pretty dark.
It's getting very sad, you know.
I put it on the watch list.
What was it that, how old were you when you decided to move away from it?
Oh, probably 10 or 12 years ago, but I was deep into it. I was in academics. I was the pastor of a church. I was a Bible college teacher for 8 years after that. I did a PhD in theology, religious studies. That's what brought me over here to the UK. I came to the University of Chester to do my PhD in biblical studies, you know, so I was deep into it. It was a long process of deconstruction and questioning things. Over the course of probably 7 or 8 years. And I'm still, you know, like you said, questioning the dogma, talking to people who are ex-pastors like me who came out of it and going into the specific teachings and things that we were taught. And we taught other people too, to believe that we're all true. You know, so it's a long process. It's ongoing, really, I think.
This year, I've worked with Steve Hassan on a couple of chapters for books. And the first one was on lone terrorists. And it meant that I had to find some people who had been influenced to become lone terrorists. Now, let's just add that up. They'd been influenced to do something on their own. So
right,
already in trouble there. So we looked at the involuntary celibate, incel, Elliot Rodger, the La Vista killer, who's largely remembered for the picture of him sat in his brand new BMW before he went out and murdered six people in Santa Barbara, California. And he left a lot of videos. He left a lot of statements. And we looked at Dylan Roof, who killed 9 people and now has a following called the Bowl Gang because he's in prison. And he wrote a rabid piece called The Last Rhodesian, which is still online because the internet's a wonderful place.
Yeah.
Where he talks about how he was radicalized by reading white nationalist, white supremacist sites. And he came to the confident conclusion, for example, that slaves were really well treated. And this is all made up. I think it's Thomas Thistlewood's journal, which is the book that anybody that thinks that ought to read.
Right.
Contemporary journal by a man who kept slaves and did the most horrific things to them. Or he could look at the photographs of slaves' backs taken in the 60s.
Oh, yeah. Horrific stuff.
But he, in the echo chamber that he found himself in, so this whole thing which became leaderless resistance, where you have people who are not being told to do anything, but they've come to believe something so fervently that they will go out and kill people, you know, as a consequence of this. Elliot Rodger was going to teach all the women in the world who wouldn't sleep with him how bad and evil they were by killing 6 people, 3 of whom, 2 of them were his housemates. And one was one of their friends who happened to wander by, unfortunately. But these perverse notions that develop now on the internet where the whole world of authoritarian groups, you're no longer looking at a Ron Hubbard or a Joseph Smith.
Mm.
You're looking at a bunch of people who get together because they're upset because they can't get laid or they're upset, you know, because they think somebody's denied them some right or other, or they've got some mad idea, like they're going to split the US in 2 and have all of the black people go that way. And, you know, there was recently some work on Viking graves, which showed, because a lot of the white supremacists now, they've decided they're Aryan Scandinavians, because that's more pure than being German, apparently. And they've recently, archaeologists have dug up graves where they found that there are Sami people, so-called Laplanders, in full Viking regalia. So it appears that the Vikings weren't racist and they interbred with people.
Uh-oh, that's going to throw a monkey wrench in the gears. Well, listen, I don't want to keep you too long. I know we could keep talking about all this stuff. This is absolutely fascinating. What kind of started out about a talk about Scientology has led into Viking graves in.
Yes. You know,
what's a good way? What's the best way for people to get in touch with you if they want to do more research on your writing, your books?
Well, my more recent book is Opening Minds, which is about, you know, how the dynamics of coercive control go through pedophile grooming, human trafficking, bullying, wherever you like. And I'm very concerned because I feel that we live in an authoritarian society and that we need to unlearn that, because if we don't, we're not going to stop fighting wars. And if we don't stop fighting wars, we're never going to save the environment, you know, no matter how. We've got to learn to live together. So Opening Minds, the book, that will cost money, I'm afraid. But the freebie, recently my 17-year-old son and I have started making some incredibly foolish videos. We have a YouTube channel called Opening Minds, all one word. You know, we go through the basics of, you know, what my work is largely preventative now. I'm trying to get over to 11-year-olds, really, and hoping that they'll start talking about this. Because if you, at the age of 11, find out what a human predator looks like and what their agents look like, how they recruit you, how they seduce you, why you're vulnerable to it, if you find those things out then the chances are that you're less likely to get yourself in a toxic relationship, whether with a partner or with a group, and you won't then have to spend all of the years that you spent unpicking.
Exactly.
What happened. So great deal of my work at the openmindsfoundation.org website. I wrote all of the content for that, which goes through the basics. But as I say, we're really desperate to get subscribers to our Opening Minds channel, which is very new. You know, there are little snippets of videos there that will hopefully be helpful in explaining these ideas. I'm also, of course, available for bar mitzvahs and weddings.
Right, of course. Yeah, 500 pounds an hour. Isn't that what you said?
100 pounds an hour. That would be very nice. Thank you.
Hey.
No, yeah. I actually take $500. You know,
you even do it in dollars. Okay. Well, we'll do dollars then. Well, I'll put links in the show notes to your YouTube channel as well as your Open Mind Foundation website. Listen, John, this has been absolutely fantastic. I was going to say once again, thank you so much to Chris Shelton for making that connection. One of these times we're going to be over in Nottingham, Derby area. We will have that pint. I'll bring you a cider from our local cider farm. It won't be 500 pounds an hour, but you'll love this cider. So we got that going for us.
Great.
Okay. Thank you so much, John.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks, Chris.
Well, I have absolutely no idea how we managed to go from John's own story in Scientology to talking about L. Ron Hubbard bombing a magnetic deposit off the Oregon coast, and then somehow ending up talking about Viking graves and white supremacist neo-Nazis. But, you know, that's what I love about John, what I said at the beginning, and that is that he has got such a wide-ranging way of looking at the world. Not only is he an expert on the cults, and specifically Scientology and L. Ron Hubbard, but he's really focused on these issues of recovering from the cultic experience. And I hope that some of the things he mentioned at the very end, as we got into some of the specifics of what you can do to recover from your experience, if, like so many of us out there, you've left a controlling religion, a high control religion with undue influence, there are ways, there are things you can do to recover. And someone like John is a great resource to tap. I would recommend getting a hold of his book, Open Minds. Go on the Open Minds Foundation website. There's a lot of really good, helpful articles on there that John has written. Very practical stuff, as I say. Now, what's coming up in the next couple of weeks? We've got a great interview that I did with Brady Harden. We're going to be talking about his experience growing up in fundamentalist evangelical Christianity, struggling with being gay, and then coming out in the midst of that. Following that, I'm going to be talking with Bill Prickett, who is also coming out of fundamentalist evangelical Christianity, who also was involved in gay conversion therapy. And these men have both come through that experience, and now they're telling their story. Now, Bill Prickett, he is the co-host of the Recovering from Religion podcast. And this is a connection that we made through Daryl Ray. We did a podcast about, I don't know, a couple months ago, and he's part of that. He's the founder of the Recovering from Religion Foundation, as well as the Secular Therapy Project. So we were able to connect through Daryl Ray. So that is going to be a really good episode, as well as the one with Brady Harden coming up. I'm still working on the one with Tim Sledge and David Hayward, the Naked Pastor. I think Tim is really, really busy because he's just come out with a brand new book. So I'm giving him a little bit of space. But we are going to do that podcast talking about specifically theological and biblical deconstruction. This is going to help you, if you're coming out of evangelicalism or fundamentalism, it's going to help you to kind of get your head around some of the real specific issues that Christians wrestle with. And in fact, this is kind of the subject of Tim's new book. So keep a lookout for that. Now, I don't want to keep you too much longer, but I just need to mention a couple of other real quick things. A big thank you goes out to Matthew P. Henry for being the latest Patreon supporter of Mindshift Podcast. You can find the connection to that in the show notes, the link to my Patreon page. If you think what I'm doing is worthwhile and it's deserving of your support, you get to be added into the closed Mindshift Podcast Facebook group. You also, as a really cool benefit, not only do you get early access to episodes on Wednesdays, but you're going to be part of the Mindshift Podcast Zoom calls that we do once a month. And in fact, this month on the 29th of September, we're going to be talking to Claudine Gallagher, who was just on the show a few weeks ago talking about post-Mormon mental health. We're going to be talking with her in our monthly Zoom call. So I'm really looking forward to dropping in on this call with Claudine. So thanks for joining me and John Atack on this discussion of what happens when you question the dogma. I hope you enjoyed it. I'll see you in a couple of weeks with Brady Harden right here on Mindshift Podcast.